welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. Today's topic is TSMC. My guest is everybody's favorite semiconductor historian and Semiconductor Insiders regular, Dr. Walden Rhines. Good morning, Wally. Welcome back to our podcast.
Good morning, Daniel. Glad to be here.
Okay, Wally. So the topic today is TSMC. You were there at the beginning. You worked with Morris Chang at TI. So tell us how this whole fabless thing got started.
Well, you know, foundry-like organizations had existed before, little companies like Seiko Epson and Supertex, but they were mostly just for the IDMs, the integrated device manufacturers, to buffer their capacity. They weren't really big. And the fabs in general had always been the bane of the IDM's existence. We always used to think that semiconductors would have been a great business if we didn't have to deal with fabs. They were always either underloaded or overloaded. They had massive depreciation costs, volatile yields. You couldn't move products between fabs and still get high yield. And during the 1986 recession, it got particularly bad because Japan couldn't lay off their people, so they kept running their fabs even when the incremental cost per wafer or benefit per wafer was negative. And so in the U.S., we'd been shutting them down and losing market share. And so it was a big surprise to us when someone actually wanted to come in and be in the business. The one that really changed it all was Chips and Technologies. Now, Xilinx was shortly thereafter, but Gordy Campbell, who was CEO of Chips, just couldn't convince U.S. companies to run wafers for him, and he didn't want to build a fab. And so he went to Japan, talked to the companies. Toshiba became his primary supplier. Fujitsu also supplied, and originally Yamaha had built some parts for him. But it became such a success that a couple of years later, when TSMC started, they actually were one of TSMC's very early customers. And Gordy thinks they were probably their biggest customer for some period of time. Subsequently, the U.S. companies, semiconductor companies, actually did see what was happening. And I know Intel and TI both set up foundry programs, but you know, our hearts really weren't in it. And the dedicated foundries really became the way to go.
Yeah, you know, Chips and Technologies, we traced it back when we did our book, the Fabless book, and it really was the first fabless company and certainly the most successful, right? Because they got bought out by Intel for $1 billion or something. But Xilinx was close, a close second. And, you know, the interesting about Xilinx is they did a business plan telling the investors that they were going to build their own fab, even though they had no they had no intention of doing so. And of course, you know, they partnered up with Taiwan and UMC and TSMC. And I think they had a fab before that in Japan. But yeah, those were the first two.
When I talked to Gordy about that, he said that he was unique in that he never had a plan to build a fab, whereas Bernie Vonderschmidt, the founder of Xilinx, was on his board and he watched what was happening. And so that influenced him.
Oh, I didn't know he was on the board. That's pretty funny. So, you know, Japan is an interesting story, right? Because they dominated the semiconductor industry, but they really missed out on the fab business. So, you know, the question is, how did the heavyweights of today get started? And why didn't the Japanese just expand on their success from the Chips and Technologies relationship?
Yeah, that's interesting. But, you know, the IDMs were really never viewed as reliable sources of foundry wafers. Everyone was afraid that when times became good, they would need the capacity for themselves and the third-party fabless companies would be pushed out. And there was also this worry about intellectual property, that you were putting your design information in the hands of someone who could be your competitor. So they shied away from it. But the timing really was good for TSMC and UMC. Morris had been group vice president of TI and ran the world's largest semiconductor business. And they had recruited him to Taiwan to run ITRI, their government-funded R&D organization. And Taiwan had a core of semiconductor entrepreneurs who had gone through a training program at RCA, people like MK Sai, the founder of MediaTek, and a number of others. And so they were anxious to get in the semiconductor business. The Taiwan government approached Morris and asked him to head up TSMC and UMC as chairman and CEO, and said they would help with the funding. But ultimately, Morris had to raise most of it himself, and He did that through a deal with Philips. UMC took a little different approach than TSMC. UMC wanted to load the fabs initially, so they built their own ROMs and static RAMs and went into the business of selling semiconductors, whereas TSMC remained a pure foundry and only ran their customers' wafers. And that was a good communication advantage because they could point out they weren't going to compete with their customers. And then Morris was able to use his TI relationships to bring in all sorts of key people. Klaus Wiemer ran the original fab. Don Brooks came in as president. Ron Norris ran marketing, a whole variety of others. And the business really boomed.
Yeah, so you mentioned Don Brooks. I know a lot about him, but a lot of people don't. I think he's the unsung hero of TSMC. I mean, can you tell us a little bit more about Don? I know you knew him, correct?
Absolutely. I reported directly to Don, and he was a terrific boss and a tremendously insightful, strategic person. And he was able to see where the future lay. And as I can probably go through later, had some of the key innovations that I think made TSMC successful. So he was a big part, although Morris was clearly the founder, the leader, the original visionary.
Yeah. Do you remember how long Don was there? He was there for some time.
Oh, quite some time. I think 10 years or more. And ultimately he left, got into a feud with Morris and ended up as CEO of UMC for a brief period, a year or so, but that didn't last.
Yeah, I heard that that's when the feud between TSMC and UMC began, because, they're right down the street. You'd think they'd be brothers, but they really didn't get along so well during those times.
Yeah, a lot of history there.
Yeah. Anyway, so let's net it out. What made TSMC different and allowed it to gain the leading market share, they have today?
Well, first, as I mentioned, I think TSMC made clear they would not compete with their customers. And then they also were, as a pure foundry, they didn't try to imitate LSI Logic and VLSI. Now, actually, Don Brooks told me when he arrived there as president, they were headed down that path, and he stopped it. He said, we are a foundry. We're going to stay a foundry. We're not going to develop gate arrays and design tools and all sorts of other things. We're just going to run designs that other people do. And he told me at that time his biggest problem was that almost everything they were manufacturing was designed to be run in somebody else's fab. And so he was spending all his resources trying to tweak his process to match. And that's where I think Don made his most critical contribution. He decided that in order to get people to design to his process, he would make it easy to get his design rules. And at that time, everyone was very secretive about their design rules. There was a thing called the Passport Library from VLSI Technology, where if you use the cells in their library, then the foundry could tweak their process to try to produce a predictable result. And you'd have one set of design libraries that could be used in multiple foundries. But it didn't really take off until Don provided them with his design rules. They based the library around those rules. And pretty soon, everybody was using the library, and Don got his wish. Everyone else had to tweak their processes to match TSMC instead of vice versa.
Do you remember what process node that was? Was that 0.18 or 0.13?
No. I think that was probably 1 micron or 0.8, somewhere in that range. While I say that was a critical decision by Don Brooks, the most critical decision in TSMC's history, I think, had to be the one Morris Chang made when they took over at the 28 nanometer node. They had had some difficulty with 40 nanometers. Yields had been poor, and it was a struggle. And they were competing directly with Samsung and Global Foundries. And it came to 28 nanometers, or the development. And Morris took the position that was not necessarily supported by his board, that it was now or never, that Morris, who was a world champion bridge player, he said, whoever has the most money is going to win if all things are equal. And so he just told the board, we've got to make sure that everything else isn't equal because GlobalFoundries and Samsung both have more money than TSMC. So in order to do that, they would have to be sure they could dominate the 28 nanometers. That meant they had to up their capital spending from about $2 billion a year to about $10 billion a year. And that was a difficult time because they had just decided to declare a dividend. This meant they would have to go borrow money to pay the dividend. And then on top of that, if that $10 billion would give them a very, very high market share for 28 nanometer, so they had to be sure the process would be successful and not have difficulties like 40 nanometer. So they turned to Shang Yisheng, their head of R&D, and said, what can you do to make absolutely certain that we have the best process? And of course, no R&D manager is going to guarantee that. So Shang Yi told them, well, if you hired 3,000 engineers, I'd have a good chance. And initially, the board said that's ridiculous. But Morris and Peter Bonfield on the board were looking at it saying, you know, it's about $100 million of incremental expense per year. What do we have that's more important than this? And so they decided, let's do it. And they massively increased their hiring and their R&D spending at a time that was critical. And indeed, their 28 nanometer process was a real winner.
Yeah, you know, I remember that. I was at, I think, Viraj Logic for 40 nanometer. And, you know, TSMC came out with minimum rules and recommended rules. So, you know, the yield enhancement rules, or the DFM rules, they called them back then. And you know, they gave people the option of doing either one or doing one or both. And, you know, a couple companies, you know, thought they were smarter than everybody else, and they didn't do the DFM rules and they didn't yield. And I remember that being a big fiasco. And at 28, TSMC didn't do that. They just had minimum rules. You had to take them. And, you know, the other thing about 28 is that was the big gate first, gate last, right? It was high-k metal gate implementation. And I'm sure you remember that, but TSMC followed Intel with gate last, and Samsung and UMC and IBM did gate first, and gate first apparently didn't yield well, and so TSMC really reaped a windfall at 28. I remember we were on allocation because they couldn't make enough wafers. I mean, that was a pivotal process node for TSMC for sure.
Well, it really was. And consider the Morris at the time is over 80 years old. This is an absolute bet your company type of decision. And you just don't expect people who've been in the business, had that great amount of success, to go bet the company. But Morris was a strategist. Morris had an awful lot of insight, and he went for it, and the board went along with him.
Well, their competitors certainly helped them out by fumbling 28 with the gate first technology. But so founders like TSMC and UMC and the rest of the guys were several nodes behind the leading edge. So what's changed now?
Well, in the early days of Foundry, one of the advantages for foundries was just a very low cost of R&D. They basically hired experienced engineers and implemented mature processes. Really didn't require much R&D. But with time, the foundries had to add more and more R&D as they moved closer and closer to the leading edge. And pretty soon they were defining their own new processes and listening to customers and innovating, and that was driving up the R&D expense. Now, they were actually able to do this much more efficiently than the IDMs, because of free market forces. They could talk to all the different customers, and the customers always wanted more aggressive design rules, and they could balance off what was achievable, what would yield, what would be manufacturable, whereas the IDMs were typically organized so manufacturing was in one group and the product groups were different, and the two fought with each other all the time. The product groups wanted more aggressive design rules and said, how can I use your non-competitive design rules and still be competitive in the market? And manufacturing was measured on yield and throughput, and they'd say, how can I have competitive yield and throughput with these ridiculously tight design rules you want? And so somebody had to make a decision, and frequently it was arbitrary or whoever had the best argument, whereas TSMC was listening to multiple customers and getting input. And I think that caused them to make really good decisions about where to push the design rules and where not to push them.
Yeah, I remember when Apple came, I mean, that was probably the big pivotal moment for TSMC because, you know, Apple said, we need a new process every year or a new process variation every year. And they wrote a really big check. So, you know, TSMC actually changed how they did things because, you know, we used to do processes every 2 or 3 years, you know, whenever they were ready. You know, it's like a fine wine, waiting for it to mature. But Apple said, yeah, we have to have a new one every year. And you know, I call them half steps or whatever. But TSMC did more incremental process node improvements based on the different years. And I think that really changed how we do business now. And in fact, just recently I heard Intel announce that they're going to do a similar thing, you know, have a process node every year. And they even changed the names, you know, to match the other foundries. But I think the Apple relationship with TSMC really was a disruptive and a defining moment for TSMC. And I think that has also allowed them to be competitive with, in fact, they're leading now with process technology.
Yeah, that was another important move. And I think you'd have to attribute a lot of that to this same phenomenon that started the company, that is fabless companies don't like to have their wafers built by someone who is competing with them in the market.
Yeah, in Apple learned that the hard way, right? Because they started out with Samsung, and then Samsung came out with a competing phone, which was, you know, head-to-head competition. And, you know, I guess it resulted in billions of dollars of legal fees for IP, you know, misappropriation or whatever. But yeah, TSMC learned the hard way, because that was a hugely competitive move that Samsung did. So as foundries move closer to the leading edge of process technology, did they have to develop the whole infrastructure of design tool and support and IP? I mean, the whole ecosystem, right?
Well, they really did, although it didn't happen overnight. The IP and the tool support became bigger and bigger issues over time. So at 65 nanometers, TSMC started what they called the Open Innovation Platform, or OIP, to bring together the key suppliers of the whole infrastructure. And increasingly, the availability of critical IP was becoming a major issue for choice of foundry. And it was also a reverse effect. People who were developing innovative IP had to choose which foundry to target first. And so increasingly, the biggest, most popular foundry would win. And that more and more turned out to be TSMC. Now, there were different diversions along the way. TSMC made a decision to utilize Artisan libraries and was thinking that because they had software that could measure which cells you use from Artisan, they could charge their customers for it. But it pretty much got rolled into the total price. So I don't think that was a big coup for them. And later, Artisan was acquired by ARM. But I think TSMC did have a big advantage in that they supported the full range of EDA solutions rather than declare gold standards. And so you had no excuse of choosing a fab because of tool support if you went with TSMC, because they would support them all. And even if they favored one, they would support all the reasonable ones so that you didn't have to limit your choice. Today, the OIP has become a major promotion. The annual meetings are well attended, and the design IP is an effective barrier to switching to alternate foundries. Customers who have done their first design with IP that they have implemented in one foundry find that when they do the derivative designs and the next generation design, they're sort of locked in. And that's one reason I think that the margins have remained very high in the 50% range for TSMC for all this period of time.
Yeah, I think TSMC, or as, you know, some people call it, they're more sticky now. And you know, when you could take a 28 nanometer design to TSMC and UMC and SMIC and just get it, you know, fabbed without change, that wasn't really sticky. But with FinFETs, it's sticky, and with as you said, the tools and IP, it's even more sticky. So you know, they just did a really good job. I was actually there when the OIP started, and you know, I was helping some EDA vendors, and you know, it was critical to get their tools in the TSMC flow, the OIP flow, because customers would ask you, you know, and if you weren't in their flow, you wouldn't be considered for a TSMC design. So it was pretty big. But you know, on the other hand, I heard it from an IDM. They said, hey, you know, they're doing the impossible. We control our flow. We have one tool flow, you know, da da da. And you know, that sounded smart at the moment, but you know, the sheer force of R&D that's put behind the OIP and the sheer force of technology that's putting into the TSMC design flow, it's just, it's a force of nature. It's I think it's probably the most competitive thing about TSMC right now.
Yeah, I agree. It's really powerful.
But, you know, even more broadly, what about packaging and other design services? You know, TSMC went into packaging a few years back, and that's not necessarily a big margin business. But, you know, again, it makes them sticky, right?
Yeah, in fact, there has been sort of a competition here among the large assemblers, Amkor and the ASE and others, as compared to the foundries. And it's a little bit of a competition saying, you know, does the package become more like the wafer, or does the wafer, does the package take on a life of its own? And so TSMC has done a lot to take advantage of the commonalities that exist in a wafer fab to optimize for particular packaging capabilities. The ability to use interposers, to stack die, to do multi-die packages has become very critical. And I think TSMC has done a great job of making those capabilities available. And more they're being utilized, especially for multi-technology chips, where it's really expensive to integrate more than one process. And by putting them multiple chips in the package, or eventually going to chiplets, you have that strength. And TSMC's done more than just the packaging. They help the customers with design services through Global Unichip, which I think is also another part of the whole infrastructure that helps give TSMC their strength in the foundry business.
Yeah, you know, we also talked about this in the book, of how important the ASIC business was to the semiconductor industry in, you know, enabling design starts. And, you know, we did a look at VLSI technology, because my co-author, Paul McClellan, you know, was an early employee for them, but LSI Logic as well. And, you know, these big ASIC companies used many different fabs. You know, Japan was a big source of ASIC business, NEC and Fujitsu and such. But then some of the fabs had their own captive ASIC services, like Global Unichip, and Faraday was UMC, and you know, Global Foundries had the IBM ASIC group. But now, if you look at it, I mean, I think ASICs still are a big play a big role in our business, and there are some huge ASIC companies, but they all seem to be attached to TSMC.
Pretty much. You know, we had some others, Jack Harding's company, I guess. He was tied to TSMC also. So I guess, yes. Yeah, you're right. Building a fab is not something very many companies can afford to do.
Yeah, I just think the ASIC business is key. And if you're a foundry, and if you're not, you know, tied up to a good ASIC business, or a value chain is what they call it, I guess, for the ASIC companies, I think it's going to be hard for you to be successful in the foundry business in general. But anyway, so let's get back to TSMC. How long do you think TSMC can keep their leading position? I mean, Intel's big. Will they overtake TSMC with their new IDM 2.0? And what about Samsung and Global Foundries?
Well, yeah, this is not something that's going to change easily. I think TSMC is in a position of tremendous power in this industry, and I don't see it changing anytime in the foreseeable future. They're well ahead in the technology, and they have incredible engineering resources. They have an entire service-oriented infrastructure and the ability to support somewhere between 1,000, 2,000 different processes simultaneously. It would take years for Intel or other companies to build up a comparable capability and develop that service-oriented culture that you need that's required in a business. Samsung is certainly much closer, but it lacks the diversity required to support the wide range of companies and processes and design styles. So I think while they will they continue to grow rapidly, it would be hard to catch up fully with TSMC. I actually think that Intel's best move would be to acquire Global Foundries, as has been rumored, even though the price sounds stratospheric at $30 billion. But I think Intel's last attempt at Foundry suffered quite a bit from just the culture and the ability to support a broad range of design tools and design styles and other things. And Intel really does have a key capability to do leading edge process development, And that's something Global Foundries does not have. Global Foundries has stepped back from that. So I think that would probably be their best shot. But could they catch TSMC? I doubt it. Not for a long time. The infrastructure is too stable, too hard to displace. Too many customers are too dependent on it.
So Wally, you know, Global Foundries would also benefit from Intel's packaging, right? Because Intel does have, you know, leading edge packaging, and I know a lot of companies want to use packaging from Intel. In fact, I think a couple of Samsung customers are going to take Samsung dies over to Intel for packaging. But Global Foundries, you know, could benefit in many ways, and Intel could also benefit in maybe being less of an IDM foundry and being more of a pure play with having Global Foundries as a storefront. You know, I just attended their Global Foundries Technology Day yesterday, and boy, their message really has changed. It's a message for systems companies, you know, solutions is what they were talking about, but it's also a message for Wall Street. I really thought they were talking to Wall Street rather than talking to us semiconductor guys. So it was quite interesting. But the pivot that Tom Caulfield, you know, initiated, I think it was 2018 when it started, really has come full circle, and they are really looking for you know, the Fortune 500 companies, system companies, and I think, you know, they're really well positioned for an IPO with the shortages, et cetera.
The TSMC, rather than being threatened by Intel, is probably more concerned about China as a threat. You know, what would happen if the Chinese government decided to blockade or invade Taiwan or something like that? Certainly, I think probably nothing would happen immediately. That is, it wouldn't be in China's best interest to shut down the exports from TSMC, but it would be an enormous sword over the head of U.S. companies, because just like China uses rare earth metals as a threat today, they could do the same thing. So I'm hopeful that TSMC will build up its engineering development capability in Arizona. My dream would be that they develop a full clone of themselves there. That would take a long time, but it's something they're clearly moving toward. When they announced their Arizona fab, they said a primary motivation was they're just hiring too large a percentage of the engineering graduates in Taiwan. It's just not sustainable. And the U.S. was another place that produces quality engineering graduates. So I'm hopeful they're going to take advantage of that. They're going to build up that engineering capability. And hopefully, over time, we won't have to fear the location in Taiwan. More and more, we'll have support in the U.S. that comes close to matching what exists there.
Yeah, you know, Wally, I agree with you about China. In fact, that's one of the most common questions I'm asked now. In fact, I was interviewed last week by Time Magazine, and they wanted me to explain to them what the Silicon Shield is, because they really didn't understand it. And it was just kind of interesting to hear the questions from people who are trying to understand this business, who have not, you know, been involved with it before. But, you know, the Silicon Shield is the world, you know, is dependent on TSMC and UMC and Taiwan for a serious amount of semiconductor technology. And, you know, if China did take over Taiwan, I think TSMC would cease to exist, at least for some point in time. And so it would be a really bad thing. But hopefully the world, you know, behind the Silicon Shield would help that. And you know, the China threat's been there forever. You know, I've been going to Taiwan for maybe 20 years now, and it's always mentioned, and the Taiwanese people just seem to, you know, not really regard it as a threat, or at least that's the way it was, you know, a couple of years ago. But, you know, we'll see what happens. But I really think for the greater good of the world, I don't think China is really that big of a threat. I hope China continues to invest in their own semiconductor technology, and, you know, they catch up in some point in time. And again, as you said, TSMC needs to broaden out to different countries, and, you know, the U.S., of course. So I think that's still unfolding, but I think it'll have a happy ending. At least I hope so.
I hope so, but I would rather that China bought its semiconductors from U.S. companies. It's just that I think they've decided we're not a dependable supplier, and so unfortunately they are building up their own capability, but I don't view that as a positive, but yeah. Anyway, we'll get through this one way or another.
Well, hopefully we have cooler political heads now and in the future, because I know the last few years were pretty tough between China and the U.S. So, yeah, we'll see how it goes. But anyway, this is a good place to stop. Thank you, Wally. Thank you. It was a great history lesson. It's great to understand the origins and really the root of TSMC and how they became, you know, who they are today. Thank you again to the listeners, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, Daniel.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.